Good afternoon, and thank you for attending. I'm going to report today on some results we have from a recently completed 7-week long project where we investigated not only nutrient regulation but also nutritional basis of colony level foraging and fire ants. So since there's been about 7 decades since the red imported fire ant was introduced into the southeastern United States, and since that time the species has spread throughout disturbed habitats throughout the southeast United States and beyond in other parts of the world where there was some disturbed habitat that was fitting for this species. You can see here from this map from the USDA that the red shows the extent of the spread that's already been found, and some areas here where it's improbable to be found, but given the right temperatures range and precipitation, it's possible that it could extend into these areas. Since its invasion, there's been billions of dollars worth of damage incurred, including money spent to to eradicate the species. And it's often been stated that there's potential negative impacts on local arthropod diversity. So the major way in order that people have used to help control the spread and the damage incurred by this species is to use bait treatments. And bait treatments are oftentimes in the form of dry granular baits comprised of a corn grit coated with an attractant such as soy oil, which is laced with a toxin. It's been reported that the efficacy of this bait is inconsistent. There's been a noted seasonal differences in the efficacy of this bait, and also differences on a shorter time scale. It may be important to understand more the nutritional biology of this species in order to increase the efficacy of baits. However, the nutritional requirements of a social insect colony are quite complex. So you can see from this picture here, the social insect colony is comprised of a reproductive queen, larvae, which are actively growing and require protein and carbohydrates, and also adult workers, which typically just require carbohydrate to fuel their activities. So there are disparate nutrient requirements within a single colony. However, it's the adults that collect the food, that go out and forage and collect the food to bring back to the colony in order to not only provide nutrients for themselves, but also the developing brood. Previous work has shown the preferences for these nutrients, and also shown that there is some sort of conflict of interest between what the workers would like to collect and what the brood require. And it's still sort of up in the air in my mind as to how those sort of conflicts are resolved, whether or not it's through the adult workers foraging for what they prefer, what the larvae need, or some sort of feedback between those two different life stages. Previous work has also focused on the flow of nutrients through the fire ant colony. However, in most of these studies, the nutrients have been treated in isolation. So whether it be carbohydrate flow preference or protein flow and protein preference. One way to get around this problem is to utilize an approach. The geometric framework is the modeling system that I used. It's a multi-dimensional state space modeling approach that has as many axes bounding nutrient space as there are nutrients of interest. So in this case here, I have a two-dimensional nutrient space bounded by protein on the x-axis and carbohydrate on the y-axis. And this approach has been used to study nutrient regulation and nutrient preferences in many different organisms, from insects through to different mammal species. And given a particular physiological condition of an organism, we can say that there's a preference or a required amount of protein and carbohydrate. And in the geometric framework approach, this is called the intake target for these two different resources. Also in this approach, we treat foods as these rails here. These are signify foods that have a particular protein to carbohydrate ratios. and this further constrains nutrient space. Now, if an organism, in this case, has an intake target of 1:1, in nature it could feed on a nutrient or a resource that has this particular ratio of protein to carbohydrates. However, more often than not, this type of resource doesn't exist. And so an insect must feed on different available resources in order to reach its intake target. This is one way that the geometric framework can be used to study nutrient regulation. Another way is to constrain an insect or an organism on a range of diets, on a single diet, that range in their content of protein and carbohydrates. And these rails you can see radiating from the origin represent these various foods. Now, when you can constrain an organism to feeding on these diets, you can obtain some information on the regulatory and also preferences of insects to these different diets. This graph here, so for instance, let's say that the insect in question has an intake target for protein and carbohydrates of 1. Now, if you look at the way that the insect consumes these different resources, in this particular instance, an organism is avoid eating excess proteins in order to reach its target for carbohydrate. So this is what's called the closest distance rule, where an insect will suffer a relatively large deficit in a nutrient that's in a large drop in the amount of nutrients of one that's in deficit. In this case, here an organism will lose. And gain the same amount of nutrients in order to sort of balance out the amount of nutrients that it loses or gains from eating excess or not enough. So, however, like I said, this approach has been used to study nutrient preference and regulation in a wide range of organisms, but ants provide a unique system with which to study colony level nutrient regulation for the reasons that I specified before, in that it's nutrient requirements of a social insect colony are quite complex. So for my experiment, I had colonies on 5 experimental diets with fixed protein and carbohydrate ratios. So these are outlined here as the nutrient rails, and the diets had a total macronutrient content of 80 to 83%. The protein components included whey protein, calcium caseinate, and also some protein from egg powder. Carbohydrate source was sucrose. So for convenience sake, I'm going to call, oftentimes I'll mention these numbers here, P1, C5, but that equates to a diet that was 15% protein, 69% carbohydrate. The remaining proportion of the diet was comprised of vitamins and also lipids, from the egg powder, which was the amount was consistent across these different diets. And the color coding is going to be consistent throughout the talk. So some of my methods: I collected polygynous colonies, because that's what we have in abundance in the area of Texas I work, and broke those up into monogynous experimental colonies having the same amount of workers and brood. And I housed these colonies in shoebox-sized plastic containers, coated with the rim with Fluon to prevent escape. I housed them in 15 centimeter in diameter petri dishes. The bottom layer of the petri dish was filled with a Castone dental stone, and was wetted very frequently to maintain humidity levels in the colony itself. And also ad libitum access to water and a food dish. I maintained these colonies in a modified room where I was able to monitor and maintain a 12-hour light-dark cycle with an ambient humidity of about around 50%. I was able to feed and monitor these colonies on a regular basis to collect data, most of these weekly, for the amount of food that was collected, the foraging intensity, worker mortality, and also worker lipid content. And I would, so these are measures of behavior and also performance. So here are the amounts. So this is a graph showing the absolute amounts of food collected. And as you can see, that the workers' preferred diets P1, C1, and P3, C1. Now, if we break these absolute amounts collected into the protein and carbohydrates collected, we can see that, again, it's seen, observed that, okay, so these points each represent one of 7 weeks, sort of a cumulative amount collected. And again, you can see that there's some sort of matching up of protein, however, with excess carbohydrates. But when we look at the actual consumption data, rather than just collection, we see that there's a tighter grouping of these amounts. And it appears from these data that the colonies might be following the closest distance rule, in that they do not collect excess amounts of one nutrient to match the amount of nutrients in the amounts of another nutrient. So there's this sort of arc rather than a linear relationship. Diet P1C5 may have been too imbalanced for one reason or another. So you might have noticed the difference between the amount of food that was collected and that which was consumed. And that is because ants hoard food. And it was very apparent from this experiment that they preferred to hoard these two diets on which they actively foraged. So 80% of the colonies feeding on diets P1, C1, and P3, C1 were hoarded inside the nest chamber or outside the nest chamber in nice piles. Not surprising, the worker foraging intensity measured as the number of workers per observation was much higher on the P3C1 diet, but also on the P1C1 diet. Higher worker mortality was observed on these two diets also, and that number of workers per observation correlates positively with worker mortality. So the higher worker mortality was observed in these industrious colonies. So whether or not the higher mortality was as a function of just being very busy and running yourself ragged is a possibility. However, we also noted that change in worker lipid content per individual. So on this, the x-axis here is the amount of worker lipid content that was observed in source colonies. So you can see that on diets P1, C1, and P3, C1, there was the colonies either maintained the level of worker lipid content, or there was a significant decrease in the amount of lipids that each worker contained. And that worker lipid content correlated negatively with foraging intensity, so that it was the lean workers that were doing a lot of the foraging. And this has been observed in the past with ants, that foraging can be triggered by changing the physiological conditions of individuals. Also, we noticed that worker lipid content correlated negatively with worker mortality, so that these workers may have been using their lipid reserves to fuel their activities, particularly on diets that had a protein bias, and that they just used up these lipid reserves to fuel their activities. I didn't show data today on the number of mortality of brood, but it was very apparent in these colonies. So in summary, I would just like to say that there was foragers preferred diets P3, C1, and P1, C1, collecting far more of these diets than was actually consumed. The rules of compromise data suggest that colonies regulate intake to avoid overconsumption of excessive resources, despite suffering a shortfall in the deficient resource. Reduced worker lipid content from colonies feeding on these diets appears to compel foraging activity. And together, the intense foraging and reduced lipid levels likely help to increase worker mortality. In conclusion, ants provide a compelling system with which to study nutrient preferences and regulation using the geometric framework. And it's important to view macronutrients in combination rather than isolation. And that noticing these combinations of resources that these ants prefer might help to produce better baits for fire ant control. I would just acknowledge the Fire Ant Initiative Action Plan and also the Beamer Lab at Texas A&M University. Thank you.